Hi everyone, my name is Christina and I am an alcoholic. Hi you guys. Oh my God, what a weekend. Thank you so much for the invitation to be here. It's been an amazing weekend so far. And I'm going to just turn on my timer here. And oh my gosh, you guys, the speakers this weekend, I am blown away. My cup is full. Every single one of you, and I am probably not going to be rattling off all your names, but I am so grateful to be, God, sharing this podium with all of you. Thank you. Again, my name is Christina, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm just going to move some things around here. And, you know, this year has been a crazy year for me. It's been a year of spiritual rearrangement for me and spiritual growth because life on life's terms happens. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's going to happen. You know, if you stay here long enough. And so life happened back in August, and you know, and newcomers, we train our feet in Alcoholics Anonymous when we get here. And if we train our feet well, when the poo-poo hits the fan, and you guys, the poo-poo will hit the fan in Alcoholics Anonymous. If our feet are trained well, we're going to know what to do. And back in August, you know, when life happened for me, because I didn't see it coming, and I got almost 29 years of sobriety in 2 weeks. And, no, that's God. That's God. Thank you. But, when it happened, I didn't know what to do. I was flooded with this emotion, this fear that I heard we talk about up at the podium this weekend. And for a moment, I didn't know what to do, but because my feet were trained, you know, because I was taught well in Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to move those feet. And I took an action. Very important, I took an action. And I made some phone calls. I called my sponsor, and I talked to her about it, and I talked to a few women that I shared this with. And then I had a commitment that weekend. I had to go speak a couple hours down south, and I normally, under normal circumstances, if I'm not living in the solution, I'm not going to be doing that. But today, I followed through with that commitment because that's what we do. And so I want to welcome you if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous. And AA is experiential here. We experience this thing. You know, it's not really quite a feeling. It's an experience. And so I take an action that counteracts how I'm thinking, right? It's a little surrender. And I take this action, and I have an experience because of it. It might just be that I meet a new girl and I get to show up for someone. It might be that I hear something that I need to hear. And it might be something even bigger, like maybe I see God for a moment. But I take this action. I have these experiences. These experiences begin to build on each other. And then those experiences, they start to challenge my old ideas. And then I come to believe. And I begin to think that this thing might work for me just like it worked for you guys. You know, and, I like, you know, spiritual awakenings here. We talk about that a lot. We talk about God a lot. And spiritual awakenings, you know, I've heard it been said that, you know, a spiritual awakening is, you know, it's not something we can put into words. We experience it, you know. And for those who have had a spiritual experience, there's no words possible or no words necessary. We get it. So if I'm talking about this thing that I experienced, you know, you're going to get it. But for those who have yet to have one, there are no words possible. You know, we have to experience this. So stay. Like was said at the podium earlier today, stay until you hear your message of hope. You know, and you start experiencing this thing and take those actions. I like to talk about identification whenever I get to the podium because I think it's very important. in Alcoholics Anonymous that we identify. And when I got here, I didn't understand this concept to identify. And when I sat among you and listened to somebody share, I would listen for all the differences and none of the similarities. And I almost compared myself right out of the rooms. And the spirit of identification is the crux of this beautiful program and fellowship, because we come from different walks of life. We come from different socioeconomic, cultural, educational backgrounds, and we all bring to the table in Alcoholics Anonymous such diversity and experience. And so as I stand up here this afternoon and share my story with you and talk about my trouble, my troubles might not look like your troubles, right? My troubles may not look like Marion's troubles, but trouble does not identify me as an alcoholic. Trouble is just a byproduct of drinking behavior. And what makes me an alcoholic is that I have an allergy of body and an obsession of mind, and I cannot safely predict what's going to happen when I put alcohol into my body. All bets are off, and one is never enough. You know, so it took me a long time to figure out that when I sit among you and listen to someone share, that I want to identify with the message, not so much the messenger, right? And I want to listen for how we drank, how we lived, how we felt, and how we thought. These four things are identification in Alcoholics Anonymous, and really it's the beginning of hope for us. We must identify to stay here. You know, and I'm so grateful to be here. You know, I'm from Akron, Ohio, in Dr. Bob's house. You know, that's where it all started, right? And Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson, way back in our early beginnings, would sit around the kitchen table at Dr. Bob's house, and they would talk, you know, well into the late hours of the evening, early morning hours. And they would later formulate, you know, talking, having these conversations, they would formulate what we have here today. And Dr. Bob would talk about that kitchen table. He would describe it as a modest piece of furniture. And what we would find when we gather around that piece of furniture would be identification, unity, and transformation. You know, and I'm so grateful that we get to gather here today and this whole weekend. You know, so in the spirit of this kitchen table AA, I'm so grateful. Thank you for inviting me, Lee, to this conference to be with these wonderful women. My sobriety date is June 19th, 1993. My home group is Pockets of Enthusiasm. We meet on Thursday nights in Brecksville, Ohio. It's a suburb of Akron and Cleveland. We're about 20 minutes north of Akron and 20 minutes south of Cleveland. My sponsor is Pat Y. She's been my sponsor for about 2.5 years, and I'm so grateful for her guidance, directions, and experience. She's steadfast, and she makes it look so easy, right? And she's only been my sponsor for, like I said, a couple of years. My longtime sponsor was Beth Gordon, and some of you long-timers might have remembered her. And she died right before COVID with 48 years of sobriety. And you guys, I was raised by the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I love our old-timers, and if you're new, you know, gravitate to them. Pull up a chair, listen to them. Just, you know, I think that their stories are like AA history to me, and I just hang on to every word. And we have Founders Day in Akron, and every year I'm there. A Sunday morning a couple years ago, we finished up the Sunday morning meeting, and I was heading over to Dr. Bob's house because my husband volunteers over there. And he was still very busy in the business house next door. So I walked over to Dr. Bob's into the living room, and there was an old-timer standing there talking to a couple of guys. And it just so happened that this old-timer was the longest-standing member of the sobriety countdown for Founders Day weekend that weekend. And he had 67 years of sobriety. Yeah. And he was regaling us with story after story of what it was like when he got to Alcoholics Anonymous. He knew Bill Wilson and he knew Dr. Bob. And after a while, people are filing in to see the house and they realize what they walked in on, and the room filled up, and I sat at that old timer's feet listening to him share his stories. And after a while, we got to thinking, 67 years is a long time to stay sober. So we asked him how old he was, and he didn't really know how old he was. And, he didn't really know, and we asked him how come, you know, and he told us in the another story about how, you know, back in the day, his mother might have been a little vain and people were private and she didn't want people to know how old she was, so she didn't tell him. And he didn't seem to mind. When we asked him what Social Security goes by, he said 105. 105 years old. And why I like to tell that story is this, that old timer at 105 years old, at 67 years sober, lives in Santa Barbara, California, and he's sitting in Akron, Ohio, talking to a bunch of drunks. Right? He's still doing the deal. And that's a powerful message for me. You know, Frankie O, and I know a couple ladies here remember Frankie O. You know, he was a longstanding member of this fellowship, and he was a dear friend, and I got word that he had passed a few years ago, and my heart broke, and I called my grand sponsor, and I said, "Pat, we're losing our old-timers." And she's 58 years sober at the time, and she lost all her old-timers, but these are my old-timers. And she, you know, she said, "Well, Christina, it's time that we pass the baton on to the next generation, and guess what, Tag, you're it." And I was expressing to her my feelings of inadequacy on the task, and she just chuckled, as she does, and said, "No, don't worry, because all the instructions are already written out for you, you know, and I don't have to worry about anything because I just go to this book." You know, and I, you know, so I'm really, really grateful to be here. I want to tell you a little bit about the gift that we get here. I did not realize that this gift was going to be as big as it was. You know, when my father, my mom and my dad sat me and my younger sister down when I was maybe 4 years old, and they told us they were getting a divorce, and I watched my dad walk out the door that day, and for the first time in my little life, I experienced this fear and uncertainty, and that fear would start to drive my thoughts and my feelings, my drinking. You know, and in Bill's story, he talks about impending calamity. And I understand impending calamity. I was always afraid of what was around that next corner and that other shoe falling. And, you know, and today, I got to tell you that I know exactly where my solution lies, you know. And as long as I'm in the solution with you, I don't have to worry about that. Shortly after, you know, my dad left home that day, he was in a car accident. He wrapped his car around a telephone pole because my dad was a big drinker. And when my mom told me the next day he had nearly died, he was in the hospital, my mom told me that what had happened, I swore I would never be like that because I couldn't understand how someone I loved so much could go out and do something like that to people that he loved. And I swore I would never be like that. And I always felt less than you guys. I hear that at the podium all the time. I'm no different. I always felt like I was on the outside looking in. I felt like I didn't get the memo that would tell you how to be, act, and talk with others. My tongue would get thick. My thoughts wouldn't come. And my peers would seamlessly maneuver through childhood and adolescence with ease and comfort, while I, on the other hand, would feel ill at ease, awkward, and uncomfortable in my own skin. And I wasn't a finisher, and I knew something was wrong with me. But my first drink changed all that. My first drink was a warm beer. My sister and I stole some beers from my mom's refrigerator. It was my mom and my new stepdad. And we shoved them under the couch with some cigarettes, and we had a friend over, and when they went to bed that night, we pulled those beers out. And I remember that beer like it was yesterday. I remember it was warm. I choked it down. It tasted terrible. But shortly thereafter, I had this warm feeling start to radiate through my body, right? And it radiated down to my fingertips and toes. And then it went up to my head. And then all of a sudden, I was enough. I was pretty enough. I was smart enough. I could talk to you. My tongue was no longer thick, and my thoughts were coming. And I found some magic that night, you know. And I began to get into trouble, you know. You know, I'm drinking in high school. I lived with my dad my senior year, and my dad would let me have the car on the weekends as long as I would drop him off at the bars. And the bars that he would frequent were on Brook Park Road in Cleveland. And these bars, there's a particular area that's seedy, consisting of these dark tank guys and gentlemen clubs. And I'd drop him off at one of these joints and go have the party because I had the car. And one night, I remember picking him up. It was 2:30, it was closing, and there was a guy sitting at the bar drinking the last drink of the night, and a couple on the dance floor dancing the last dance. And over in this corner of that bar was my dad sitting at a round table with his back against the wall, and he had his hand cupped around that glass and his eyes lost in that drink. And it took me a long time to figure out what it was about that moment that seared in my memory. And today I know that was the moment that I knew that alcohol had my dad. And I swore once again I'd never be like that. But I was already well on my way in my own alcoholism. You know, and my father was an alumni of Ohio University and was first in our family to go to college. And he wanted his oldest daughter to follow in his footsteps. So all the plans were made. And, you know, my senior year I'm doing a lot of partying. And as a result, I don't make the necessary credits to walk the stage and make that milestone. And I didn't think it was a big deal. You know, I'm not hurting anyone, right? But today I know I robbed my parents of the right and the privilege and the joy to watch their oldest daughter walk across that stage. But I was able to scrounge up those credits in summer school. And at the end of August, I picked up my high school diploma and off to school I went. And let it be known that Ohio University is a nationally ranked prep school for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had arrived. The bars were all in walking distance. My parents were 5 hours away, and I had to declare a major. I ended up I had to audition for the school of dance. I had dance in high school. I loved it, but I had no class, no technique. But I was able to squeak by. They gave me an audition with choreography, and I happened to be pretty darn good at choreography, and here I'm in the school of dance, and I loved it. You know, it's not a fluffy degree. It requires some pre-med. So it was anatomy, physiology, kinesiology, biology. It was great. But I really just practiced my craft on the dance floor with a drink in my hand. And OU sent me packing, and I moved up to Columbus, Ohio, and I started drinking on High Street with all the college kids. And I quickly moved to the outskirts of town, because that's just how I drink. And women were the enemy. I didn't get along with you, you know. And I knew what the deal was with men, but women forget it. But I befriended this one woman. Her name was Cherokee, and she ran a traveling dance group, and she wanted me to join her troupe. But the girls, they would all frequent these dark dank dives and gentlemen clubs, and they would take off their clothes. And this kind of dancing, I thought at the time, was beneath me. And I would hang out with those girls and ride that wave as long as I could because there were free drinks to be had. But truth be told, you know, towards the end of my drinking, I'll end up on Brook Park Road with all those dark, dank dives and gentlemen clubs. I'm the queen of geographical cures. I could do a geographic without even going anywhere, guys. You know, and I did things like try to join Big Brothers and Big Sisters. I tried to join the church, Mother Superior, at the Catholic Diocese in Columbus. She did not find me a good match for the church. I did successfully join the Army. They took me, but I have to tell you, a direct result of my drinking, I got discharged from the Army, and I ended up living on the streets of Cleveland. And I at this point, things were getting very dark for me, and I'm moving from street to street because I don't want you to see how I'm living. And I'm sneaking into restaurant bathrooms and taking bird baths in the sinks because I don't want you to see how I'm living. And the shame and the remorse of my day-to-day life, you know, I'm horrified if you catch me. And on a dead-end street, I'm trying to figure out how fast I need to plow my car into this building and not survive. I got a six-pack. I got the dog in the back seat because we're living in the car. And instead of ramming my car against that wall, I finished those drinks, and I end up at a bar on Brook Park Road. It was a hotel, and I remember running into a couple guys. They were nice guys from high school. I didn't hang out with those kind of guys. But they were really, you know, concerned that I was living in my car, and the one young man, his name was Rich, he invited me to stay with him and his family, who consisted of his mom and his dad, his sister, her husband and children, and they welcomed me with open arms. And I love the dynamics that I saw in that family, and I always wanted that for my family. Today I know that I have a wonderful family. The family was never the problem. Christina was always the problem. But, you know, this dynamic, we'd have dinners together at this family's house, and the young man, his name was Rich, and one night my drinking became a topic of dinner discussion, and here I found myself in an Alcoholics Anonymous household, because the father of this young man was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, he took me to my very first meeting. It was on a Thursday night. And I remember two things. It was smoky in that room, and you guys were really, really happy. And on the back of that meeting, whatever it was, I went to another one on Friday night. It was the West Clifton Group in Lakewood, Ohio. It was 300 large, very overwhelming. And I walked in late, and I sat in the back. And I'm getting ready to walk out early because the meeting is just wrapping up and I don't want to talk to you. I just don't know what to say, you know. I don't know if I belong here. And I see a young man walking towards me and he has a look on his face like he knows who I am and I have no idea who he is. And he catches me. See, he thought I was my sister who spent a year in Alcoholics Anonymous because of her drinking. And she was 17 to 18. She spent in AA. And he thought I was her, and he had these dark eyes and this dark hair, and he's really handsome, and I took a hostage. And those two meetings would be the last two meetings I would go to for a while. And we had this crazy, turbulent, violent relationship. His name was Rick. And then we had two beautiful children together. And in 1992, it was sweetest day, Rick came home with a bottle of champagne after 9 years of sobriety. And he said, honey, I think I was just too young. I think I could drink safely. And I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know anything about alcoholism. But I knew this. I knew he was in trouble. But I do what I do. And he opened that bottle of champagne and we drank it together. And then I went off in this direction and he went off in that direction. And we didn't really cross paths much. And the progression of his disease was quick. He picked up right where he left off and then some. And my drinking took me to dark places, doing dark things with dark people. I burned bridges. I hurt my loved ones. And I emotionally and darn near physically abandoned my two children. And the type of mother that I was when I came to you, finally, was this. I would come to at 2, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd be hungover, very sick. And my babies would be hungry. They'd be locked in their cribs, hungry for breakfast and their mother's love. And I was incapable of giving them all of the above. You know, and their diapers would be saturated with urine and feces, you know, and they needed cleaned and cared for. And I would leave them with people who were no better suited than I was, you guys, to get to the drink. And I got to tell you, I love my children more than anything in the world. I really do. And I would leave them in bad situations and people who were no better suited, you know, worse off than I was, just to get to the drink because I didn't want to be like my dad. You know, the delusional thinking that we tell ourselves. And I left them with a couple one night because I needed to get to the drink. I needed a little relief. And this couple, they were in bad shape, and my youngest was 5 months old. I know this because I remember he started crawling, and I left him with them. As I'm sitting on a bar stool, my youngest crawled behind their couch and got pinned, and he remained pinned for over 5 hours. That is the type of mother that I am when I put alcohol into my body. All bets are off, even my children. So there's a series of events that occur that bring me to my last drunk, and I'm face down on the west side of Cleveland. I'm in some joint on a couch, and I'm coming to a voice, and it's my children's father, it's Rick, and he has my babies in his arms. And I'll never forget the words that he spoke. I'll never forget the look on his face when he spoke them and the tone of his voice. And he dropped my babies on my back, and he said, get up and be the mother you are supposed to be to these children. And he turned around and he walked out. And at that moment, I knew the pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization that our literature talks about. I scooped up those boys and I put them in the car. I know I was still drunk. And I drove home. And that day, I got a little bit of that advanced grace we talk about. Something was cracked open in me, you know. And so I called a woman and she started taking me to meetings, you know. She had reached out to me at one of those two meetings I had gone to. And I called Janice and you guys gave me some direction. I heard the gift of desperation was talked about this weekend and I had that. You know, because I was just desperate enough to listen to what you had to say, and I would sit in the rooms and follow some directions. I might not have heard it all right, but I would try. and you told me to come early and set up, make coffee, set the tables, you know, put the chairs out. You told me to stay after and clean up coffee cups and ashtrays. What does cleaning ashtrays have to do with me staying sober? But cleaning ashtrays has everything to do with me staying sober, because of all that early activity, those actions that we take, you know, they carried me through until I was able to put the steps into my life. And I would sit among you guys. I sit among you and I'd feel this comfort. And then pretty soon I would have this comfort on my way to the meeting in anticipation of sitting among you. And then I would have this comfort leaving the meeting, and pretty soon I was experiencing it between meetings. And my life got better. You know, I'm tasked to talk about 8 and 9. You know, and I'm kind of new to this format. You know, so I love, it's really hard for me to wrap my brain around talking about a step in isolation. Because they're fluid in nature, right? And so, you know, I need to have taken the step prior to move on to the step, like step 7 to 8. I need to have that experience. And Bill was such a craftsman of the written word. And he was just so skilled when he would write, and he foreshadows what's coming next, you know, and the end of chapter, in the 12 and 12, the seventh step. And I'm going to read this, this quote. He foreshadows what we're doing in step 8. He says, "The seventh step is where we make the change in our attitude, which permits us with humility as our guide to go out from ourselves towards others and towards God." And so that tells me what I got to do, right? I need this humility to get out of the way. I need more God and less me. And having the humility will move me out of the way so that I can go on to the next step. And I think that these steps are mechanical in nature, right, when we first start. Because I didn't understand what I was doing when I started this process. I'm just taking the actions. I'm going through the motions. But as time goes on and we practice these steps, these principles, that I start to have a shift in thinking and perspective. And I begin this process of this emotional and spiritual damage that I have to address. And I love the saying, and I think I heard it on the West Coast first, to be right-sized. I love that. I had never heard that before. And to me, what that means is that it means that it doesn't mean that, you know, I'm less than or I'm better than. Standing in a place of judgment, it means I'm right-sized where I need to be among you, and that I know what I am and I'm not. I'm not God. And so I have to have this humility to start this process. And the old timers were priming me and I had no idea. And I had an old timer pull me aside as I was in this process. And he said, "Christina, you need to be childlike and teachable in order to learn something about sobriety here in Alcoholics Anonymous." You know, and what I heard was sit down and shut up. because I needed to hear you. And, you know, Bill talks about those old ideas. And Bill's story talks a lot about old ideas. And when I'm working with a new girl, one of the first things we do when I'm starting this process with them is we'll read and pray the set-aside prayer to just kind of, you know, be open-minded to new things. And then we'll start talking about those old ideas. We'll go over those quotes out of Bill's story that he mentions, just because we come in with so many different beliefs and ideas that anchor us to our disease, keeps me stuck. So then I have these this ability to kind of start to let go of some of these ways of thinking and to be open to some new information so I can do something different, so I can see something different. And when I was preparing for my eighth and ninth step, I was preparing to do an amends, and I was whining to an old-timer. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I do not recommend that. I was whining to this old-timer about what had happened to me as a child, and she stopped me dead in my tracks, and she said, "Christina, when we begin this process, when normal people begin to grow up and take responsibility when they turn 18, they, you know, they grow up. They start to take these responsibilities. You know, they do things. They are accountable. And when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, we're well overdue." And I was really offended by that old-timer at the time. But I'm so grateful today for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous who are not afraid to hurt my feelings. Because what she was saying was not that I'm responsible for what happened to me as a child. I'm not responsible for that. But what I am responsible for is how I feel about it, how I think about it, how I react to it, and how I take actions on those things. From day one at birth all the way to today. And I gotta tell you, you guys, that is a huge freedom for this alcoholic. You know, and her name was Claire, and I'm so grateful for that old time and all her old timers, and I had to fetch myself up sharply, right, as the book says. And eight is about forgiveness. Mentions forgiveness, I had to start thinking about, oh my gosh, I have to forgive these people too. I'm asking for forgiveness, really. And I have to, start, you know, doing some work on my end with that. And, you know, I know that in seven, we talk about that judgment. And I do think that, you know, here also, if I am not willing to forgive you, I'm still judging you. So I feel like I'm still, you know, I got to continue to work on that judgment. Again, I can't be better than you and I can't be less than you because I get in trouble that way. And I got busy doing these steps. Step eight is made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And this step says that I look at my past relationships. I repair the damage, and then I go out and try to be the best human to others as I can. And I'm paraphrasing that whole thing. And I had my list from four and five, and I made that list for eight, and I added a couple other people that I didn't have resentments for. And I made my index cards. That's how I was raised. I made index cards. And on that index card, you know, each of them said that this is the harms that I'm aware that I caused you. And then I would list them. You know, and I had a box, and I put them in there. And step eight also is about willingness. And I think willingness is everything in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, in Akron, we have an inner group. We have these golden books. I don't know, maybe some of you old-timers are aware of these golden books that we have, right? They're not AA-approved literature, but they are Akron beloved literature. And the author of these little books, his name was Father John Doe. And he was, and that is his anonymous name. His real name is Ralph Pfau. I might be botching his last name. It's German, I think. But Father John Doe he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was a priest. And he was good with his words, and he wrote them down. And he has a few books out there about sobriety and recovery. And he wrote these golden books, that there's 14, I think. And one of them is sanctity. And when I think of the word sanctity, I think of sainthood. And we are not saints, right? And I am no saint. But what Father John Doe goes on to say is that sanctity is about having God's approval. And how we have God's approval is through willingness. And all I need is a little bit of willingness. One of the things that I heard when I got here was all I needed was a little mustard seed, size of willingness, and I could have what you had. You know, and I had no idea what that would be. So willingness is everything. I didn't know how to be willing. You know, and I remember asking the questions, you know, how do I get willingness? And I remember being told a lot, pray for willingness. And how do you pray for willingness? What does that look like? You know, and I was really kind of frustrated with these questions. But what I learned over the years is that I take action. I take an action and it counteracts what I'm thinking. And over time, willingness comes. You know, I come to, and I come to believe. My ninth step, my ninth step, I gotta tell you, well, let me read this step. May direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And I was talking about my part when my sponsor and I were talking about the ninth step, and she corrected me on that. What she told me was that it isn't your part. She said, because if you have a part, that means somebody else has a part. That means that I'm not taking full responsibility. and so she said, it's our mistakes we're talking about. So, I was really excited. I'm on the ninth step, and I had made two amends. They were small little amends, and I went out and made them, and I got really eager and excited and overzealous, and I decided I was going to make amends to my mother. And it was a big amends, and I'm driving over to my mother's house. It's Saturday afternoon, and she's going to have lunch. And we're going to sit at the dining room table and have lunch. And I get there, and my sister is there, and she's an active disease. She is actively drinking, and she's there. My stepdad is sitting in the living room watching TV, which is an open floor plan, so he's sitting in the room, and I'm sitting at the dining room table, and I don't have the guidance from my sponsor. Not that she wasn't giving it to me, but I didn't seek it out when I decided I was going to make my amends to my mother's that day. And I'm sitting there, and I decide to make those amends in front of my sister and my father, and that is not what I should have done. And I proceeded to tell her about my part, and then I shared with her about her part. And that didn't go well. And imagine a ball full of legs, arms and legs rolling around underneath the kitchen table. Because me and my sister ended up in a physical fight. And my father is yelling and my mother is crying. And I'm hurting the people that I love. And I'm supposed to be going to make amends, to make it right. I didn't seek the guidance that I needed. And so it took me, you know, I think it was Clancy that talked about inches and seconds. You know, I didn't have this thing yet, you guys. I was just still moving my feet. And so, you know, when I left that house that day, you know, I'm like, what happened? I got sideswiped. What happened? It wasn't supposed to look like this. It wasn't supposed to turn out like that. And I knew this thing wasn't going to work for me. I knew it wasn't going to work for me like it worked for you. And it took about 3 weeks. Thank God I kept my commitments. I wasn't doing really well, but I kept my commitments. And I eventually, I think it was 3 weeks, I called my sponsor and I told her what happened. And she proceeded to tell me what I did wrong there. And what I know today is that I need to discuss situations when I have big amends like this, you know, when I have questions. I need to be clear on what I'm doing when I go out and make these amends. And I needed to pray. I needed to bring God with me, you know, and I needed to have an open heart. And so I recognized that I fully didn't accept responsibility in there, and going back, you know, to my parents, I made proper amends. One of the things that I learned about, though, you know, is there's some questions that I need to ask when I'm doing amends. And on, you know, on one of my cards, I have four questions that I ask. And one of them is, are there any more harms that I've caused you that I need to know about that I'm unaware of? And then I shut up and listen. I need to ask, what would you like to tell me how my behavior affected or hurt you? And I shut up and listen. What would you have me do to make right the wrongs I've done you? And I shut up and listen. And then, what is there anything else that you would like to share with me? And I shut up and listen. And I proceeded to make those amends to my mom and my dad, my bio dad and my sister. And today we have beautiful, beautiful relationships together. I'm very grateful that I have my family. You know, my parents are still alive, and I was able to restore those relationships. My sons, they're grown up, they're 31 and 29 today. They were raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was a new girl, I would take them to meetings if I didn't have a babysitter. And if they were disruptive, we would leave the meeting and go outside and play, and then I'd come back and I would talk to the women. And they had a lot of behavioral problems, my children. And the women in Alcoholics Anonymous, you told me this was normal for newcomer women. And as I stayed sober and got well, they would too. And this did not happen for my children in my circumstances. It happens for most women. It did not happen, and let me tell you why. My children would later be diagnosed with a serious illness that there is no cure, just treatment. And I was devastated, and I wallowed in some heavy self-pity. But you guys didn't let me do that long. You made me pull up my big girl pants, and you told me that I needed to do some footwork. So I got busy doing research on my children's illnesses. And first it was layperson's information, and then it turned out to be medical journals. And I became quite an expert in the area of medicine concerning my children and their illnesses. And you taught me things like stand at the door and shake hands. The girl who couldn't talk to people. You know, welcome the newcomers when they're coming in. Introduce yourself. And when I come into a meeting, and we do this in the Cleveland-Akron area. I don't know if we do it in other parts of the country, but, you know, when I come into a meeting and there's women already, you know, members already in attendance, that I'm to walk around and shake your hand. I need to introduce myself. You know, and because you taught me how to talk to people and all the other things that you taught me, I learned to advocate for my children. You know, and I could talk to the doctors and use medical language to help get them the care that they needed, and I'll be forever grateful. And they're doing pretty well. My oldest son, he's navigating his world just fine. He's a great young man. He lives independently, which I never thought would happen. And, you know, I'm setting him up. You know, he has a condo. I purchased a condo for him, and you know, so I'll have a place to stay when I'm not here, you know. And we're setting up trusts. My youngest son is struggling. My youngest son has this particular illness, but he also has our disease. And so it complicates things. And he's not doing well, and he could use prayers. But I know that there's nothing I can do about him and this disease. God has him. It's none of my business. But I have to help him with the illness because it requires medication and medical care. So I did not get to make direct amends to my children. You know, they could not handle the direct amends. And I talked to my sponsor, you know, how do we do this? Because I can't do this, it'll hurt them. And after talking with my sponsor for a little bit, we decided that it wouldn't be good to do that, that I make living amends, you know. And so I show up for them. There was that family that I stayed with when I was drinking. His name was Rich. His father was Richard, you know, with his sister and all the kids and everything. And Rich was a high school friend. And we weren't really close or anything because I was drinking. But we became friends on Facebook, and it became apparent. It's just, you know how, and I think somebody mentioned it. You know, it was just heavy on my heart. I needed to make an amends to this guy. You know, and I talk about, you know, staying with this family every time I share my story. And I'm like, oh, I need to make these amends. And I started praying about this. And what had happened was we became friends on Facebook. And I reached out to him. And we exchanged numbers. And I told him I wanted to make an amends. And he goes, oh, it sounds like that you're in a 12-step program. And I said, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to talk to you about the harms that I've caused. And, you know, I got to make that amends to him. And he turned around and he said, I'm in a 12-step program. And I want to make amends to you. And I was like, what? But today we're friends. And I was very grateful for that. You know, the book says that we continue this for a lifetime. And I'm of the school of thinking, you know, today it's 10, 11, and 12. But I was brought up that 10 is really 4 through 9. So I am practicing 4 through 12 on a daily basis. And we continue this for a lifetime. You know, Rich's father, Richard, he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He took me to my first meeting. I wanted to make amends to him, and I wanted to thank him. And I didn't know if it was going to happen, and I brought it up to Rich. And he said, yeah, sure, I'll reach out to my dad and see if that would be okay. It didn't sound real confident. I didn't hear from Rich, and I didn't want to pursue that because I'm not here to make things more difficult. Not today. And so I just prayed about it. And I'm on Facebook, and I see I'm on some sober Facebook pages, and I see his father's name making a post on one of these sober sites. And I'm like, oh my goodness, and there it is. So I say some prayers, I call my sponsor, and I decide to reach out to him on Messenger. We're not friends. I don't know if he's receiving it. I sent two messages, and I basically wrote out my amends. You know, we make direct amends whenever possible. Well, he's in North Carolina, and but he did. We did connect, and I got to make those amends with him. And you know, so this thing is—it's fluid. These steps, gosh, they carry me. You know, all of them, and I'm so grateful to be part of these conferences where we talk about these steps in detail. You know, my dear beloved sponsor. Well, I want to tell you about Rick real quick. Rick was my children's father, you guys. And he had, like I said, 9 years of sobriety when he picked up the drink. He loved Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a Pied Piper here. He had a following of young people. You know, they did a lot of things together. He started meetings on the west side of Cleveland. And, you know, I had a front row seat watching this thing rob him of everything that he valued and loved, especially Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and he became very sick from the drink. He became a wet brain. But he did make it back into the rooms, and I want to paint that picture for you, because he walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous with his pants around his ankles, and he had no idea. And the men in Alcoholics Anonymous, they scooped him up and got him situated, and you guys brought him in, gave him coffee, and talked to him. You made him feel welcome, because we don't shoot our wounded here. And I'll be forever grateful. And he caught me at a lucid moment, and he said, Christina, I got to tell you, I got 1 foot in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous and 1 foot out, and I can't get back. And I had no idea how profound that statement was, you guys. because he got sicker and sicker. And in 1995, it was January, he was supposed to come over and have dinner with his boys. It was his birthday. We hadn't seen him in a long time. And I invited him over. He was coming over. He was excited. And he didn't show. And I made some phone calls to check on him, and I didn't hear anything. So I thought, okay, everything's all right. And the next day, I got a phone call. It was his mother, and she called me to tell me that that they found Rick dead in his apartment with a bullet in his head. And the autopsy report said that he carved his initials in a 9mm bullet and shot himself in the head. And what I can tell you about that is this. There are no bad examples here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can learn from all of you. You know, and he did not die in vain. And I'll never forget the banner that hung behind the podium of my first home group. It said, "Watch well your beginnings. The results will manage themselves." So my dear beloved sponsor, my longtime sponsor, Beth Gordon, I would call her DBS for dear beloved sponsor. I'd call her DBS. She used to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous being the greatest love story ever written and ever told. And you guys, isn't it true? From our earliest beginnings at bedside to our humble neighborhood meetings and home groups, you know, it's gatherings such as this, you know, Founders Day or just one alcoholic sitting down at a kitchen table with another, that we find that we're home. You know? So, this process has given me so much. It's given me my family back. It's given me a God that is big, experiences that I wouldn't want to miss, you know? And it's allowed me momentarily, time and time again, to experience the presence of God. You know, and I'm so grateful to be part of this weekend with all of you. I'm so grateful for Lee, for the invitation, all of you for being present, and I want to thank you for my life.
If you would, we have a beautiful way to close.